You know, when you're rebelling against something, your life is still defined by it. Rebelling against a thing does not make you free from it.
Welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams, and that is a smidge of my conversation with the pastor, Nadia Boltz-Weber. Now, she's a pastor unlike any other. She is 6 feet tall, covered in tats, curses like a sailor, retired stand-up comedian, and she is making the religious right a smidge uncomfortable with a lot of her writing and a lot of her ministry. Nadia is also the founder of House for All Sinners and Saints, a church in Denver, which I'm going to get to as soon as I can leave my fucking house, and has a new podcast called The Confessional. She has written 3 New York Times bestselling memoirs, Shameless. That is the title of her latest book. And when we hear shame, we come a-running. Like us, Nadia is committed to breaking the shackles of shame. She even has a video series she created called Forgive Assholes, which is brilliant. I wish I would have thought of that, but I didn't. In her book, Shameless, Nadia interviews people, asking them the messages they got growing up in their church around sex, sexuality, their body. Gotta say, shame is there all through it. We talked to her about her journey away from her church and then finding a God she could do business with. Throughout our interview, what I kept on being reminded of was how important it is to never apologize for who we are. Here's our interview. Stay tuned.
We tell ourselves the story of our lives, and then we commit it to memory, and then we just tell it over and over again as if it's just some unchangeable truth. And I'm just aware, like, I'm telling a different story about my upbringing now than I did for a very long time. And I'll explain why, but yes, I was raised in the Church of Christ, which is like very sectarian. It's very, I call it Baptist plus, you know, and lots of rules, lots of gender stuff. I never even heard a woman pray out loud till I was 27 years old because women weren't allowed to pray out loud in front of men. Like after we were 12 years old, all of our Sunday school teachers were men because 12-year-old boys had more authority in that church than grown women did. And so once boys were 12, women were not allowed to teach them anymore. I mean, it was that intense.
Did they start to separate you too? Like girls went to this? No, they didn't separate you, but there was no authoritarian.
But there was no female authority figure, right? Wow. And we were separated on youth trips or summer camp. If we went swimming, you weren't allowed to swim in the same pool. They called it mixed bathing, which sounds so much kinkier than it was, sadly. So, and there was just all this weird stuff about sex too, just this kind of obsession about sexual purity and making sure that you don't think sexual thoughts and that you are remaining pure all the time and whatnot. And
can I ask you one thing?
Yeah.
Were you getting the same kind of messages at home with your parents?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Occasionally, but not nearly as intensely. And what's interesting for me about that is in my book, Shameless, I interviewed people for nearly a year and a half about what message did you receive about sex and the body and gender from the church, and how did that message affect you, and then how did you navigate your life as an adult? And what I found is 85% of the things I heard from people, the messages originated from youth pastors, from youth group leaders, from Sunday school, from Christian summer camp, from retreats they went on, much, much more than they originated from their parents.
So did you start questioning any of this?
Well, of course, developmentally, you don't even have the equipment to do that until you're a certain age. And that's why it's so weird when you grow up and you get to a certain age and you start looking at it critically and you realize that your upbringing was weird. You don't know it's weird. It's normal when you're in it, right? And so the thing that really made me go, I don't know about this, was these two things were in conflict. When I was told something was true, and then I experienced something in my actual life, and they contradicted each other. that was the moment where I thought, what am I supposed to do with this? So the example is like being told like homosexuality is a sin and these people are outside of God's grace and you shouldn't be around, you know, this kind of influence and all of that. Very shameful. And then I was this really sort of outcast girl because of these health problems I had growing up. I experienced a lot of alienation, but then I met this one group who ended up thinking I was fabulous, and that was the gay theater boys in high school, right? Amazing. They loved me, and nobody loved me before, and that love problematized a lot of things in my life because I thought, wait a minute, these guys love me. They're amazing. I trust them. They're so filled with so many beautiful things. This is my actual reality I'm experiencing. Here's the thing the church taught me. What am I going to go with? You can't deal with that much dissonance for that long. And so I just kind of eventually went, well, fuck it. I'm going to go with what I'm experiencing to be true. I can't ignore this truth in my life in lieu of an idea I was taught. I don't know. It was like, if it doesn't make sense. That's why the premise of that book, Shameless, is like, look, if the teachings of the church are harming people, and they are, we rethink the teachings. We should never be more loyal to an idea or a doctrine or an interpretation of a Bible verse than we are to people. So all of that stuff, which decades later comes out in my writing, originated in me as a 16-year-old, you know?
So let's back up a little bit what's the progression of growing up in Colorado Springs, and then I don't know much about your story, but I know that you're in recovery from, you know, drugs, I suppose drugs and alcohol, but like how you went from, you know, the 16-year-old super active in your church to like the shit storm, and then how you found your way back to, you know, being a pastor. Hello, who does that, right?
No, it's crazy. So what happened was, you know, this incredible sense of betrayal when you realize that the whole worldview you were given doesn't feel true. You know, like all this stuff that I was told about what it means to be good, what it looks like to be good, who God is, what the world, all of that, that whole thing just started to crumble. You take one Jenga block out of the bottom and it collapses. And the only thing I held was like I never managed to be an atheist, but when I left the church, I still was really into Jesus. I just thought, this is the one thing I can kind of hold on to, and the rest just felt like bullshit. And I left when I was like 16, and I was so angry about my religious upbringing for a very long time. And but again, I was out there trying to find something to replace it with.
How'd that work out for you?
I actually am really grateful for what happened. I mean, in some ways I tried to find it in, you know, living in a house with drug dealers. And I mean, you know, there were some missteps along the way, but I got really interested in like Wicca and feminist spirit, women's spirituality. And I spent years in that scene, and I'm so grateful I did, because I had to like bask in the female face of God for a long time to heal something in myself before I could go back to my original symbol system. And so I'm really grateful I had that time. I have tender feelings towards it. But I always felt like a visitor, you know. I didn't feel like a member necessarily. I think it's a recent concept in human history that you can choose your symbol system, that you can be like, I'm gonna be this, you know? It's not very long in human history that we've even thought we could do that, because our symbol systems form who we are in a really foundational way. And for me, there was a feeling of alienation when I couldn't access my own symbol system that I was raised with. And so for me, I found it 10 times more liberating to come back to Christianity, but on my own terms, in a way that didn't feel like I had to betray myself or check my brain at the door or pretend to believe shit I didn't. Like, to come back felt 10 times more liberating than leaving for me. So I didn't have anything to do with Christianity for 10 years. And I got sober when I was 22. And I think it was the moment where I was willing to sort of engage with prayer in a different way. I was desperate enough to do what people told me. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the program I was in was finding a God you could do business with. And I was like, I can't deal with that God that I was, that, you know, the one I describe as the like angry, capricious bastard who has a killer surveillance system and who's like always disappointed in you for just being a human being. That's the God I was raised with. And so I think it began that sort of construction of a different concept for the Almighty, for the Creator, for the Spirit. And I met this very nice man who was from a small town in Texas, who was a Lutheran seminary student. And I'd never heard of Lutherans. I think I heard Prairie Home Companion on NPR a couple times. So that's all I knew. But he introduced me to a form of Christianity I just didn't even know existed. I didn't know there were Christians who were really, whose faith was really rooted in social justice and in contemplative practice, and I did, it was this whole world I didn't know existed, and I just got subsumed in it.
Can I ask you a question about the seeking part, or, you know, searching for something and turning to things that are outside of ourselves, like drugs, alcohol, sex, self-harm, whatever, you know, do you feel like during that period of when you left the church to the time that you got sober, that you were still searching for God, but doing it in, you know, in a harmful way?
Yeah, I do. To me, it was not, it wasn't like, well, I don't believe in any spiritual principles, or I don't think that there's a God. It wasn't like that. It was there, the world is so much bigger than I was taught, and I'm going to reach for as many things as I possibly can in this life, because they were all restricted to me my whole life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, you know, when you're rebelling against something, your life is still defined by it. You're not rebelling against a thing does not make you free from it.
You know? Has so, the opposite effect, really.
You're still so tied to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's still deciding what you do.
Do you think you're, because you're pretty open about, you know, your 12-step life, do you think that that was kind of the thing that really got you to look at this idea that what you said is you can create a God, you know, that you can do business with? Do you think that that was a real big shift in your getting back to or creating a new symbol of faith for yourself?
So I'm a public theologian. So now professionally, what I do is I'm a theologian, but I'm a Lutheran theologian. But I'm a Lutheran theologian specifically because of all of the hours of my life I've spent in the basement of churches. I mean, my concept of God and how God operates is a million times more defined by sitting with a bunch of drunks talking about God than it ever has been in sitting with a bunch of pious church folks and talking about God. So if anybody like listens to my sermons, read my books, and sees my videos, all of it is just, it really is very Lutheran theology. And that's because the basic tenet is that the point of gravity in Lutheran theology is grace. It's this idea that God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. Like, I think that basic idea in the 12 steps defined how I view God, defined who I am as a theologian, and the way that shows up in people's lives. So again, it's not just an idea. Like, there were a lot of ideas I was raised with that when they couldn't hit the pavement and walk, right? I was like, this is just delusional. But what I see in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in people's lives, I see actual human transformation. But unlike in the rest of our society, it's not as a result of just trying harder, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, power of positive thinking, like all of the things that were sold either with the fucking secret or purpose-driven drivel, you know, both in New Age and Christian circles, that idea that we can control everything by thinking the right things or praying the right things. I never saw that shit work in an addict's life ever in the way that just giving up, letting go, letting God, being aware that God does for you what you can't do for yourself, taking your fucking inventory, telling the truth about yourself, cleaning shit up. I've seen real human transformation through that, in a way that the messages that people are very drawn to, I don't see the same transformation. So does it happen and I don't see it? Possibly, I guess, but it just feels like bullshit to me. And it smells like bullshit in the way the stuff I was raised with does. You know? I'm like, I'm sorry, it feels delusional. I don't see it in actual reality, you know? So I just think actual reality has just always been my starting point as a theologian, as a pastor, as a writer, more than ideals, idealism, ideas, any of those things.
When did you know that you had this gift? You went to seminary school, but you also knew that you had a gift to share with those other people that you say in your book and on your newsletter, the people in the corners, which I just love, which are like the freaks, the weirdos, the drunks, the, you know, the sex workers, all of those people. When did you realize that you had something that could offer them a place, a mm-hmm. safe place, a place of hope?
Well, I think it's just because they are me.
Yeah.
No, I'm always suspicious of that weird blend of paternalism and benevolence that happens sometimes when people are like, I just have a heart for, you know, fill in the blank, some group you're not a part of. You know, for me, it was just, look, I have to culturally commute from who I am to who most churches are, and it's really uncomfortable for me. And yet, these ideas, these theological concepts, this idea of grace, the liturgy, the prayers, all that stuff is so meaningful to me. But the only way I get to access it is if I like dress differently, talk differently, not talk about my whole story, definitely don't have my sense of humor, cover it. You know what I mean? Like all of these things that are sort of expected, more traditional churches, I'm not going to do. And so I guess for me, I've just always felt a call to be like a pastor to my people, rather than a pastor in more of a general way, you know? I mean, the story that I tell in Pastrix about feeling a call to ministry was a friend of mine from my 12-step meeting who was also a stand-up comic. So we were in these two, we had these two circles of our lives intersect, and he was a good friend of mine. And he died by suicide. And my whole friend group just look at me and they're like, well, you can do the funeral, right? And I hadn't been to seminary at this point. I just was literally the only religious person in my friend group. And so I did it, and I'm giving his eulogy, and I'm looking out to this packed crowd. It was at the Comedy Works in downtown Denver. And it's all these comics and queers and academics and alcoholics. And I just look out in the sea of people and I think, these people need a pastor. And then the second thing I thought was, oh shit.
That's you.
Yeah. So it's a different model, I think, for spiritual leadership. Like my congregation would always say that they love having a preacher who's clearly preaching to herself and just letting them overhear it. You know? So I guess I'm just part of the group that I'm writing for or preaching to. I'm never separate.
I wish I had your church when I was younger.
Yeah.
It's I think you're probably helping a shit ton of people. I love the story in the in your latest book where there's a, I think it's a trans woman. Mm-hmm. And she says she doesn't ever really join. I guess when you guys do the meals, mm-hmm. she doesn't really want to mix. And she always sits by herself, kind of off to her side. And you're like, that's kind of where you go, mm-hmm. you know, kind of on the outside or in the corners. And I just think that such a beautiful story. Can you share a little bit about your conversation with that?
Well, I think it's a very natural instinct within human beings and within human societies to set up who's in and who's out. I mean, I think we do it in a million different ways. And so I think it's like a natural thing that we want to exclude so that we can feel safe. Like, so we can feel like we're in, we have to know who's out. And we do that in a million ways. You see it in like social justice people on Twitter. You know, you see it in, well, what's keto and what's not keto? I'm sorry, if you're eating this and it's, you know, my friend Dave Zoll wrote a book called Seculosity that was so genius, where he's like, look, people think that they, because we don't go to church anymore, we've stepped aside from all these things we think are distasteful about it. We've just replaced them with other things. Instead of yammering on about only thinking clean thoughts, now it's like only eating clean food. And instead of how much time you spend at volunteering at church, it's how much time you spend at the gym. You know, there's millions of ways that we're like earning our worthiness and virtue signaling. And, you know, I'm like, that's why I think our drug of choice has just always been like knowing who we're better than. And that shit in the human heart will fashion itself in endless variety. And so to me, I think just living a spiritual life is just having this constant daily repentance of like, where is it creeping in? Like, how is my pride defining the way I'm interacting with someone? Why is this reaction to this person that I'm having? What does that come from? You know, it's that daily inventory, as they say in the 12 steps, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the spiritual life to me. Spiritual life is not nailing it. To me, it's not, it's when you finally get it all right. That shit, if somebody's told me they got it all right, I'm like, no, you didn't, because you just lied to me. Boom.
Yeah. There's no getting it all right. It's trying to like do a little bit better every day than the day before and be able to offer forgiveness and love and compassion, like all those things, not right. Judgment and punishment and shame. Right. So let's talk about the book, Sexual Reformation, and why you felt the need to write it.
Well, it's because even in like this really progressive denomination that I'm ordained in, I still had to sign a document when I was ordained that said I would be faithful in marriage or celibate in singleness. And since I was married at the time, I didn't really think about it. And I was walking through London and all this stuff was swirling in my mind, and I stopped walking and I thought, why did the institution of the church make me sign a document promising I wouldn't do this? How is it that they trust me with the care of people's souls and they don't trust me to make grown-ass decisions about myself as a sexual woman who's middle-aged? I mean, it just made no sense to me. And I Skyped with Eric and I said, and he's a heathen, he's not Christian, and I said, why do you think that the church has tried to control sex for so long? And without skipping a beat, he just goes, I guess I assumed that the church saw sex as its competition.
Wow. Like, bingo.
Oh, I was like, oh, I'm writing a book. I am definitely writing a book. So that was the origin of it, was going, even in this progressive church that I'm in, they still had this hang up about no sex outside of heterosexual marriage, which made no sense. When we were living in an agrarian society and there was no reliable birth control and you had to know sort of who was going to inherit the farm and who was your blood relative, you know, I mean, there were ways in which that sexual ethic made sense when the age of marriage was about 45 minutes after the age of puberty. You know, all of that made some sense. And yet we transferred it into this context and it doesn't make any sense anymore.
So you mentioned earlier, you were collecting books about sexual health for decades. And then you wrote this book, Shameless, and you were interviewing members of your congregation. Mm-hmm. And why did you feel the need to kind of put this book together and and the messages that the church has put on anybody practicing, you know, the shame around sex and sexuality and our bodies?
I feel like it's such a big part of who we are that to have this huge percentage of the population sidelined from Christianity because they don't fit in that small circle felt irrational to me, really.
Do you think that you're the Nadia that you were always meant to be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like an integrated person. Like I do feel like, and also I get to be like a person for a living. Like that's what I kind of set out to do and to be. And I feel very fortunate. Yeah. Yeah. I am shameless. I mean, I think that a lot of, you know, most of my readers are women. And I think that's the thing they are attracted to, is that I don't, if I'm in front of you, I'm not ashamed of my body. I'm not ashamed of my voice, of my opinions. So I think like there's this sweet spot for authority and leadership right now, which is to like not apologize for ourselves, not be like self-apologetic, always apologize if we're wrong, but like have humility, but don't apologize for who we are. Like to be in that space between those things, I think is the sweet spot that I'm seeing, especially for a lot of women in leadership right now.
Mm-hmm. It's just hard. Sometimes it's so hard to stay in that sweet spot.
Yeah.
But I guess we do that by surrounding ourselves with other women who can kind of carry us and mirror.
Yeah.
For us. Yeah.
The healthiest women I know have a lot of female friendships.
Yeah. I'd be dead without my friends for sure.
Yeah.
You know, especially right now. One thing you're working on that I saw on your website is this idea of how do we forgive assholes? And I think that could be a really good way to kind of end the interview, just mm-hmm. because of where we are now. And how do we forgive assholes? What's our prayer for assholes? Like, do we offer a prayer, you know, for Trump? Do we offer a prayer for Harvey Weinstein or those that have, our abusers or the people who are, you know, the predator in chief? Do we pray for them?
Yeah, I mean,
should we pray for them? Do they deserve our prayers?
Does anyone? I mean, I think the way I can find a place of prayer or compassion for people is to go, whatever has blossomed, whatever bullshit thing is in like full bloom within this person that is so despicable, I have at least a seed of it inside of me. Just a tiny seed. And maybe it's never sprouted, but I just can't imagine it's not there. You know, I have a little bit of the narcissist in me. Like I can go, oh, I can see how with completely different environment and stimulus, how that part of me could have really blossomed. And yet I'm grateful it hasn't. And it's not because I'm a better person. You know, like I think finding that place of compassion when you know somebody's full story is feels better in my body than just standing in judgment and anger over them. I can't maintain that for long, but when I can get to that place, it just feels better.
Anything else that you would like to say, especially during this time of uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
How do we support each other?
Yeah. I just think people are doing it. They're being really creative in doing it. I mean, look, I don't think hope is the same as vapid optimism. So I can't be one of those like cheery as fuck people, but neither can I just default to despair. I can't bear it. And so, I am seeing these things that are happening that really are beautiful. Like the planet is just getting a breather from our bullshit, which is incredible. I think people are realizing how important we are to each other in a way that we took for granted. I want to go to church, which normally I don't. You know? I love the idea of going to church right now because I don't get to. So there's some beautiful things that, I think just allowing people to be where they're at too, not forcing down people's throat, either the everything's going to shit and this is the apocalypse, like not like insisting people be there, but also not insisting people see the flowery good things as well. I mean, I think just giving ourselves a break to just be wherever we are and to go, it's okay. It's real, but also it's not forever. You know, whatever I'm feeling is real, but also temporary, you know?
Thank you, Pastor Nadia Bolz-Weber.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Nadia Bolz-Weber. Holy shit. If I had a priest or a pastor like her growing up, oh my God. Well, I wouldn't be here doing this work, that's for sure. Anyway, check out her videos, a podcast series, books, and her church. It can all be found at Nadia Bolz Weber, BOLZWeber.com. We've got a lot of recordings that touch on this issue around sex, sexuality, gender, and the church and religion. Have a listen.
Yeah, I'm not even sure really where to start with this. And there's been a lot of things I've done and experienced that like have brought me shame. Some of it's not my fault. Some of it's the conditioning I was brought up in, like growing up in like a super fundamentalist family. And it really fucking is horrible. Like the first time I had sex with my girlfriend, like feeling ashamed about that. And and actually like that's probably where most of my shame lies, just like around sexuality and and how it's something that's so beautiful and precious and sacred. And yeah, sometimes like I still feel like some like weird like shame around it, and expressing it and feeling it in my body and feeling awkward like sharing that with like others. I know personally I feel like really ashamed like about masturbating and thinking about people without their consent. Yeah, ugh. I feel really gross about that. Both like real people and like looking at porn on the computer. Ugh. And I just so wish like someone would have taught me when I was younger. I wish my parents would have taught me. I wish there wasn't so much shame around it, like in my family and and I wish like my parents didn't make me feel ashamed for like having those feelings and desires and like me having to like to shut down and bury that for all those years. And and I'm just so grateful in this moment for all like the teachers I've had, like the former lovers and girlfriends, and for bringing me healing in that. But I still notice like just like the way I move my body and the way I dance, like there's like a disconnect between like my sex centers and the rest of my body, and like I just hold everything in my chest and my arms, and I just so want to be like embodied in like my pelvis and to feel like integrated, like, and to be able to live from that place and like my gut, and like I just shut down like my intuition, the literal like gut feeling through the years, and I'm sick of it, and I want to like be centered in my power there and listen to my intuition, and I want to feel empowered, like more and more my sexuality and an expression of that and directness in that, and my claiming of that, my place here in the world, and yeah, so I forgive you, Mom and Dad. I forgive all the people that brought those teachings of shame and fear and rejection to them, and yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. So, thanks for listening, whoever's on the other end. And, yeah, have a great night.
All my life, I've always grown up thinking that it's never okay to like someone of the same sex. It was never okay to love someone if they were a woman. And it took me a long time to realize that, you know, I really am, like, I'm attracted to women. And I feel like a lot of that to blame is my grandma, because she's so religious, and I just, like, I didn't want to make her feel disappointed in me. I didn't want her to think less of me than what I didn't want her to not love me. And one day I really just want to embrace the way I am and the way I feel towards the same sex. And I just really sat down with her and told her, hey, if I ever loved a woman, would you feel the same? Like, would you love me the same? Would you treat me any different? And she didn't give me a direct answer. She just kind of thought, hey, I was confused and I didn't know what I was talking about. And a while back, a few days ago actually, she told me, no matter what I love or who I love, she will support me. And that's why I really felt the need to come to Pride, because, you know, I need to embrace the side of me that's been hidden for so long, for 18 years, because I felt this way for a while, you know? And it just feels so nice to finally embrace who I am and who I love and not feel ashamed to feel that way. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Well, I would have to say that it's just a simple fact that most people don't know what you go through. Most people are alone in the world. Coming from the country, being in the Bible Belt, it really messes with your head. Coming out here and then experiencing all of this, not knowing who you truly are because you've been, you know, ashamed of who you are and everything. But it's time to stop. It's time for us to rise up and not separate ourselves more than what we've already been separated. It's time to let that light that's inside us shine beyond anything, because a star can't shine without a little bit of darkness. Thank you.
Oh my God, seriously, folks, like, the shit is real. The shame that we carry individually and collectively. And we are living in a time when shame is flying so high. People are losing their jobs, their homes, their health. They're losing loved ones. Families are falling apart. Domestic violence and child abuse is skyrocketing. And our leadership, talk about forgiving assholes, our leadership is going down the motherfucking toilet. And we probably have some things we would like to say or unburden ourselves. So call the Shame Line. 888 Shame Line. Call anytime. It's there for you, and you don't need to be 6 feet away from anyone. It's just you and the phone.
My name is Paula Williams, and this is Shame Booth, a podcast series about getting proud. To learn more, please go to shamebooth.org, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on the Instagrams, and get your Shame Booth on. Shame Booth, the podcast, is produced by Sound Made Public with Tanya Katanjan, Philip Wood, and Katie McCutcheon. And Shame Booth, the team, is me, Paula Williams, Retta Roland, and our new hire, Haley Ireland. And to all the Shame Dames waiting patiently in sheltering in place, we thank you. Be safe, be well, for your shame, wash your hands, be nice to your neighbors, forgive assholes, know you are not alone, and that we are here. In our next episode, Tiffany Schlain, a speaker, a filmmaker, and a writer who wrote a book, 24/6, The Power of Unplugging One Day a Week. Keep listening and be well.